Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Before I turn in motion, turn a tender eye to me. Those tingles in the ocean, sweeter than any harmony. But you blinded me with silence. She blinded me with silence.
Good morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. It's Saturday the 28th of December 2024, so it's our final science show of the year. That was a very slow intro,
yes,
from Thomas Dolby.
I think it was matching the beats per minute of the other track.
It was indeed. You got Julian Paul here live, as always. We've got Chris Dale in the studio with us.
Greetings, team.
Greetings. Hello. And we'll be speaking to our PG later in the show. Next week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, all being well, it's Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. He'll be on the phone, or he may even be in the studio. He'll be talking about Eye on the Sky and lots of other things, including club news. And talking of club news, Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society doing an event today, or this evening actually. So Santa bought you a telescope, or brought you a telescope. So it's Saturday the 28th of December, that's today, between 4 p.m. and 8 p.m. at the J.A. Jones Huber Observatory up at Huber Stand, or near Huber Stand. And it's a free event, but you must bring a telescope or a pair of binoculars. So if Santa left you a telescope, or if you have one at home gathering dust and would like to know how to use it, bring it along to the J.A. Jones Observatory today between 4 and 8 p.m. Members of the club at Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society will be on hand to show you how to set it up and use it to observe the heavens. In addition, they will be on hand to advise on all things astronomical. They may even have time to show you around the observatory. We'll have to see. Next up.
Yes, just before that, the pea soup has disappeared today, so hopefully tonight at the observatory,
well, we hope,
it should be a lot better for viewing. Anyway, next, the Big Garden Birdwatch. You take part in the UK's biggest garden wildlife survey by watching the birds for an hour between 24th and the 26th of January. Last year, more than 600,000 people participated in the RSPB-organised event. Grab a cuppa and record the birds you see in the garden from your balcony or in a local park. Then log them on the RSPB website. Details at rspb.org.uk/birdwatch.
OK, Great stuff. Now, what about a book for the new year? I saw this in the press, A Year of Living Curiously, 365 Things Worth Knowing by Elizabeth Foley and Beth Coates. Here we go. These are some of the facts you can find in the book. How do great white sharks breed? Witnessing the act is thought to be the holy grail of marine biology, and there's one fisherman in New Zealand, apparently, who claims to have seen it happen in 1997. He described two sharks belly to belly with the male biting the female to hold her in place. The ultimate love bite. Female sharks' skin is thicker, and this behaviour might give us an evolutionary reason as to why. Next one. Why do things taste awful after you clean your teeth? So everyone knows that orange juice tastes disgusting after you brush your teeth. This is because of sodium lauryl sulfate, foaming agent in many toothpastes. Now, it's not in all toothpastes.
No.
So we buy one that doesn't have it in, I think. This chemical suppresses taste buds, sweetness receptors, and breaks up the natural compounds in orange juice that reduce its bitterness. It only takes about half an hour for the effects to dissipate, and then you are free to glug joyfully at will.
Even your wine tastes horrible, doesn't
it? Everything does. Now, this is a really interesting one. Where did the word Bluetooth come from? Bluetooth was developed by the Swedish mobile phone company Ericsson and named after the king, the Viking king Harald Blattan, 910 to 987 AD, or Anno Domini. The English translation of Blattand is Bluetooth, and the technology's symbol shows its initials in the old Nordic written language of runes. Harald apparently got his colourful name because of a dark, dead tooth, rather than because he loved blueberries, as some stories claim. Another one for the book, from the book, how were microwaves invented? Well, as a US geared up to enter the Second World War, a man named Percy Spencer was working on developing combat equipment. Percy worked on the magnetron, a tube in which electrons moved in a heated spiral pattern, emitting radiation that could be used in radar. He realised one day that, as he stood next to an active radar set, the chocolate bar in his pocket had melted. He tried it next on corn kernels, which began to pop, and an egg, which exploded. He filed a patent in 1946, for which he received the standard $2 from his company. The first microwave was the size of a small car and priced it about $5,000. But in the 1950s, they took off in a big way. And Percy never received more than that $2. Can you believe? Back down to earth again. The cold is creeping deep inside. Disconnect the telephone line. Gotta get away, gotta get away, get away, gotta get away. For the Lord, don't make me stay. All I know should've been, could've been. Last way out of this, swayed by a deceitful kiss. Said you better stay, said you better stay, better stay, said you better stay, for it's all now gone away. All that I know should have been, could have been.
Better stay, better stay.
And that was All I Know by the Screaming Trees. Because we're talking about a book called A Year of Living Curiously, 365 Things Worth Knowing by Elizabeth Foley and Beth Coates. It's out now. Maybe go and buy it. You are, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. We should have our PG on the line.
I wish I was a spaceman, the fastest guy alive. I'd fly you around the universe in Fireball XL5. Way out in space together, conquers of the sky. My heart would be a fireball, every time I gazed into your starry eyes. We'd take the path to Jupiter, and maybe very soon we'd cruise along the Milky Way and land upon the moon. To a wonderland of stardust, we'll zoom our way to Mars. My heart would be a fireball, 'cause you would be my Venus of the stars.
And what an intro, PG. Especially for you.
Yeah, good stuff, eh?
It is. Well, we knew what you were going to talk about, so we thought, aha. A special one. Rather long, though, Paul, I'm sorry to say.
Oh.
I think Chris would like to say good morning.
Hi, PG. How are you doing, mate?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself, Chris?
Yeah, happy new year to you, mate.
Yeah, and to you. Hopefully, yeah, it'll be a good one.
Yeah.
So, PG, what's caught your eye in the news today, then, or this week?
Well, a couple of things. One sort of downward-looking and another one upward-looking. So, looking down, sort of reading some background news about the Thames Super Sewer. And it's about 25 kilometres long, and eventually it came out at a cost of about £5 billion. And that's supposed to help fix the problem of pollution in the Thames. So I wondered about the sewerage system that preceded that. And Joseph Bazalgette was the designer of the London sewer system that was implemented after what they called the Great Stink in London. The problem with sewage, and it was things like open gullies in the centre of the streets, which were carrying away waste of all kinds. So he built a system, I think, 11,000 miles, 1,100 miles of sewage pipes, and a central sewage system, which was sort of constructed, I think, over a period of just under 10 years. From 1860 to about 1875 for the final bits. But at that time, it cost £4.2 million for all of that. So if you sort of extrapolate, this new super sort of tunnel is probably costing as much as the whole sewage system back in 1860. And it's not going to be paid for out of the blue. It's going to be extracted from customers at a rate of about adding £25 a year to their bills ongoing. So it just sort of begs the question of how do we get so poor at being able to do big construction projects? It just seems that, you know, after the failure of things like HS2, it just raises a lot of questions about the country and how it's going to manage its infrastructure, and whether we can rely on things like clean water and no sewage pollution. So I just, if you look at those kind of figures, it's going to be very expensive. And yeah, this was before sort of massive machinery. A lot of it was a bit like the canals. It was done by pick and shovel. And had a saving grace that I think Bazalgette chose to use Portland cement. And the thing about Portland cement is that when it comes in contact with it, it keeps hardening. So that's what's kept the system that he built going for quite a while.
he was quite clever as well, because he actually almost future-proofed the system, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
He built it way, way bigger than he ever thought would be needed. And thank goodness he did, or we'd be going back.
Yeah, well, I think the population sort of burst upwards past 4 million in that period, towards 5. So London, in its heyday, was really expanding very quickly. But that was looking down, and I thought, well, what else has been happening in the news this week? And you might have caught the sort of background to the probe that's circling the sun and analysing the activity on the sun, looking at what drives the corona that we see in an eclipse. And the current probe is called the Parker Solar Probe. It was launched in 2018. And I think it's the fourth probe, in a series of probes. What it does is it uses the orbital sort of acceleration around Venus to fire it towards the sun. And initially when it was put into orbit, it required a bit of correction to get into the correct alignment. And what it does, it's got an elliptical orbit, so it gets closer to the sun. And I think this time around, it got to something like 4 million miles from the sun. And it's the closest, I think, that a man-made object's got to the sun. And you start to think, well, hang on, it's going to be really hot. So how's it managing to survive? And it has a heat shield, which is an amazing sort of development. It's carbon on carbon with a foamed carbon sandwich in the centre of it. So this large heat shield that protects the actual probe is, in weight, about 73 kilograms. So it's doing a job, because that barrier that's put in place between the sun and the probe means that the instruments on board don't get warmer than about room temperature, about 82 degrees. So it does a phenomenal job. And it's actually sort of looking to see what it can analyse from the magnetic field switching that happens on the sun. And it's collecting data. So the last close approach, there were a couple of days when it was out of contact, which was a sort of fingers crossed time for the people at NASA. And it came out and transmitted some data. I think, sadly, it's really programmed to approach the sun, and its corrective thrusters are running out of fuel as it goes on. So it will eventually turn the heat shield away from the sun and expose the instruments to the power of the sun. And that should effectively destroy the instruments. But the heat shield will apparently be orbiting the sun for millennia.
Wow. Amazing. But you know, it's the closest man-made object it's the closest anything's ever been to the sun, but actually it's still a long, long way away from the sun, isn't it? Something like 4 million miles.
Well, I think we're about 90 million, so it's a big bite out of the distance between us and the sun to get that close. And I say it's interesting that the sort of planetary law that governs the trajectory of projects around the gravitational fields of planets is the fastest man-made entity. It came 4.3 million miles, going at a speed of 430,000 miles an hour. So I think if some of South Yorkshire's finest are there with their radar traps. That'll be a cap. That's amazing. It's done some tremendous work, and it'll be interesting to see what comes out of the data that's actually been created from these excursions around the sun. And it's from the National Academy of Sciences Space Science Board, and they proposed several missions. I say there was, I think this is the fourth probe that's been around, and it's interesting because the switching magnetic field creates these solar flares, and it's the kind of thing that you can see, say, around the periphery of an eclipse. And those solar flares generate an energy that we measure back on Earth. But if you go back into the time of sort of AM and FM, AM radio before FM radio, some spots would cause that sort of weird drifting whistle that you used to get sometimes when you were tuning into Radio Luxembourg for the latest pop things. It had started.
That sounds like a clangor, Paul.
Yeah. Well, it kind of did. It sort of made that strange drifting noise. So, also the sun generates a cloud of particles that come our way, and those particles are actually the driving force behind us getting the Northern Lights, which I thought was quite a nice tie-in to Christmas.
Oh, very good, Paul. Indeed, all good stuff.
Yeah, well, I think hopefully our Phil can tell us a little bit more about it if he gets a chance. But I think, I'd say, it's really interesting to look and see what it is. I mean, the cost of these things, sometimes people go, is it worth it? But this probe is going to do, I think, 24 orbits is predicted to be able to manage. And also, because it's slingshotting around Venus, you're getting some data from Venus as well. So, bit more of an understanding of our place in the universe.
Indeed. You see why we played you in on Fireball XL5? What a cracking piece of music. We've been watching that series. It's phenomenal for the time it was done.
Oh, yeah. Good fun. Yeah.
Brilliant, Paul. Yeah.
One of my favourite toys when I was at Christmas time, I got a Fireball XL5.
Lucky you.
had a big rubber catapult. Used to fire it up in the air, and it produced its own parachute to come back to Earth.
And mate, I bet you wish you still had it, Paul. You'd be on Antiques Roadshow, no doubt, making loads of money.
Yeah, well, sometimes the parachute didn't work that well, so...
Brilliant. Great stuff, PG. So, thank you. Final science show of the year, all being well, we'll speak to you next Saturday as
great,
well. And Monday's last glory days of this year.
Oh,
I know. Bye-bye, Paul. I know. Happy New Year. Yeah, it does indeed. Happy New Year, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
And to you all. Bye. Cheers. Bye. Bye. Thank you.
beautiful track there. A bit of early Pink Floyd, Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun. And we played that because our PG was talking about the probe that's circling the sun at the minute, called the Parker Solar Probe, I believe, if I was listening to him correctly. Anyway, if you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM, on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every week. If you tune in regularly, you'll know we generally have a guest speaker. And just because it's in between Christmas and New Year, that doesn't stop our people coming in or being on the phone. And we've got Chris Dale in the studio with us. Good morning, Chris.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be here, but I'm going to sort of sound like I'm a real misery because we're in between Christmas and New Year, and I'm here to talk about the impact of ultra-processed food, and today I'm going to be talking about sugar.
You are indeed. And interestingly, PG's been picking up on this as well. He's bought the book by Chris Van Tulliken, and I read an article about him yesterday saying we shouldn't even be calling it ultra-processed food because it's actually not food. Which is another food for thought, I suppose. But yeah, you're going to be talking about sugar because this is a really interesting one.
Yeah, just before I start that, I just wanted to say that if you were to make a lemon drizzle cake and you went and you bought all the ingredients, the cost of the ingredients would be somewhere around just over £4. For an ultra-processed food lemon drizzle cake, the cost of the ingredients is 23 pence.
Yeah.
And that's why we have ultra-processed
food. Yes.
So the single biggest reason why children under the age of 18 will have an anaesthetic in a children's hospital is to extract decaying teeth. So these can be milk teeth or permanent teeth, and in almost every case this is completely preventable and is a result of too many fizzy drinks and the consumption of sugar. Now, just to put that sort of context on that, that is somewhere between 40,000 and 45,000 operations a year to remove a child's rotting teeth. I mean, that is just outstanding. So a dental surgeon that works in a hospital in the northwest of England said that most of her patients were aged between 5 to 9, but it was not uncommon to remove all 20 baby teeth from a 2-year-old because of decay. And she also says that she's extracted a 14-year-old's permanent teeth due to fizzy drinks, and they will now need false teeth.
Which is not a great, it's not a great thing.
It's entirely preventable. But the issue is, of course, and we've spoken about this on the Live Science Show, sugar is everywhere in a child's diet. And, you know, I'd challenge anybody to go to a shopping in a supermarket and to find foods without preservatives, emulsifiers, salt, sugar and fat. And it's not just in sweets, biscuits and sugary drinks. It's also in sauces, gravies, soups, cereals, pie, bacon, chorizo, supermarket garlic bread, pizza and just your regular bread.
Which is quite astonishing amount of sugar and salt that's just in most breads.
It's in, well, we spoke about it as well. You make bread at home and it's 5 ingredients. You buy bread from a supermarket, it's 21 ingredients.
But it's all about shelf life, isn't it?
It is all about shelf life and also making sure that the bread doesn't start to dry out, that it remains soft, it remains bouncy. They use additives that sort of make the grain go further and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, not good. So, what I wanted to say as well, and to give everybody an example, and we have mentioned this before, that there's a chocolate cereal called Crave that's made by Kellogg's, and it's made especially for children, and it's a chocolate-flavoured cereal. And the key ingredients are wheat, oat flour, chocolate flavouring, sugary oil, palm oil, cocoa, whey powder, glucose syrup, then has emulsifiers. Well, if you could help me with this, Julie. Soy, lecithin, citric acid. It's got salt. It's got colorings, which is annatto.
No bixin. Carotenes.
Yeah, it's got antioxidants in it. Ascorbyl.
Palmitate, alpha tocopherol. I mean,
that is amazing. You've done really well there.
You can't even spell them.
Let alone, yeah. But, you know, food like this surely should not be allowed. I mean, that is specifically aimed at children and it has absolutely no health benefits at all.
No. And, you know, they called it Crave.
Sums it up.
Crave. Well, the government may have to intervene and start doing something about it then.
Well, you know, my wife and I, we went to a popular supermarket just before Christmas to do our Christmas shopping. And there were just rows upon rows on boxes and tins of chocolates, cakes, donuts, biscuits, fizzy drinks. And they're all placed where you can't miss them. And on top of that, there were a load of special offers. Buy one, get the second half price. And the amount of sort of sugary stuff, it was just, we just said it's getting beyond ridiculous now.
And it's all beautifully coloured and pretty and attracting young children, and it looks glittery and shiny. And
it also makes you sort of feel, well, it's Christmas, so I need to treat somebody by giving them sugar, you know. I mean, 60, 70, 80 years ago, it was a treat to have sugar.
It was.
Whereas now sugar is just everywhere and sort of takes over the diet. But the other thing that I wanted to do was just talk a little bit about some research that was done on sugar, and it's about cutting the consumption of sugar during the first 1,000 days of a child's life. And the researchers were able to take advantage of what they call a natural experiment, which is when at the end of World War II, food rationing came to an end. And sugar rationing and the rationing of sweets and chocolate came to an end in September 1953. And consumption of sugar went from around 41 grams a day, that's around 10 sugar cubes a day, and it doubled to sort of 20 sugar cubes almost immediately.
That's still a lot back then.
Well, it's still a lot back then, yeah.
But diets were different and people generally used to eat sugar for energy.
Yes, that's why you'd have three in your...
Lucozade and three sugars in your tea.
Yeah. Three in your cup of tea to keep them going.
So the researchers were able to look at three groups. So the first one was mothers who had conceived and had babies during their first 1,000 days of sugar rationing. They were able to monitor mothers that are conceived during rationing, but the babies were brought up after the rationing stopped in 1953. And then the last group was mothers that conceived and brought up their babies after sugar rationing ended. So this is what they call, like I say, a natural experiment, because they were able to have a point in time where they were able to judge when the sugar intake had increased. So all three groups basically were very close together. They lived through the next 70 years and went through lots of sort of similar changes. But the one thing that was different in their lives was this consumption of the sugar. And then what they also did was look at the impact, say, of butter being stopped rationing and other foods that were stopped rationing. And they were able to determine that there was no impact from those being
interesting.
I know. So the research showed a 30% reduction in the risk of obesity for sugar rationed babies. It also showed that by limiting the intake of sugar in the early life cuts the risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 35% and high blood pressure by 20%. So the risk of type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure does increase with age, obviously, but it increased a lot faster in people that had consumed more sugar in their early days. It also showed that mother's diet during pregnancy was very important, with a third of the benefits of a low sugar diet impacting while the baby was still in the womb. However, the greatest health improvement was seen where sugar rationing covered both the periods of the womb and when the baby was weaned onto solid food. So, to cut a long story short, basically, having sugar in your early part of your life increases your chance of ill health later on. And it's, you know, it's
even
pretty...
in the womb. Yeah, it's an interesting one. And the thing is, it's almost as though the baby's been born addicted to sugar. It's like you wouldn't want a woman to smoke or drink alcohol when she's pregnant because of the impact on the baby. But actually, you're almost addicting your baby to sugar.
Well, it actually, the research did actually show that. It says, you know, maternal diets that were high in sugar have been linked to a higher risk of obesity. And also, it's possible that eating sugar whilst very young sets up a lifelong preference for sweet foods. And that, to me, was, you know, absolutely shocking. So whilst we know a birthday cake, bit of chocolate, bit of cookies in moderation are treats, you really need to start thinking about people having a sugar-free diet at the start of a child's life, because that's possibly the best start in life. But what was interesting is the researcher also said that trying to avoid sugar is far from easy, as it's everywhere, and it's even in baby and toddler foods. And I know that that's going to be a subject for a different show. That in East Asia now, there's a crisis happening because parents are feeding their children processed food, which are very high in sugar. So I was going to do a piece of that maybe next year.
Yeah, excellent.
But I think you're right, Julie. You know, when you turn around and we talk about ultra-processed food, some of it is just so highly processed and they put...
It's not even food.
It's not proper food.
It's industrial chemicals and stuff.
And we just say the best thing that anybody can do is to cook their own food and freeze it.
Well, it's control the amount of salt you put in your food, control the amount of sugar. You talk about baby and toddler foods. If you puree your own fruit and vegetables... There's going to be no sugar and salt in that. But it's often about preservatives. I mean, we had Denise Pullum, a friend of yours, on early on this year. She was from America but lives in Sheffield now. But she was saying over in America, the issue of preservatives is another one because of the distances that food has to be transported. So you can see why in some respects you might want to preserve food, but there's a balancing act there, isn't there?
And I spoke to my friend who lives in Cape Cod, Phil Howarth. And he said that they won't buy supermarket beef anymore. They literally buy a cow straight from a farm that they know has been grown organically because the beef has got so many additives and
antibiotics
and stuff like that in it.
It is,
and so they won't. He won't touch the meat in America anymore, and just buys a whole cow and butchers it himself.
But on a happy note, it's coming to the new year, and you can change your diet and you can change what you do, and you don't have to do it all at once. Because we all started by looking at what was in a bag of crisps.
That's right.
And it's true, as simple as that. You can look at a bag of flavoured crisps and see how many additives there are compared to, say, a packet of plain crisps. And then we just eat plain crisps now. And it's tempting, isn't it, to eat, you know, your giant Wotsits or whatever you taste really nice, because it does make you want to eat more and more and more.
Yeah, because a bit ago we bought I was going to buy a tuna and mayo sandwich and looked at the ingredients and I couldn't find any tuna.
The last time we needed to buy a ready-made something at lunchtime, we went into, I will mention the name, Marks and Spencer's, bought a loaf of freshly baked French bread, a piece of cheese, and it's got no... No, yeah, the bread has got some additives in it, but it has to be eaten on that day. It's not packaged up, it's cooked fresh, so it's got less additives in it anyway. But fantastic stuff. You've done a great job this year. You've covered all sorts, Chris. You know, the BBC will be poaching you.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I've really loved listening to the Live Science show. It's been brilliant.
So excellent. Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Love is like a bomb, 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 bomb.
Hey!
Sheffield's very own Def Leppard there with Pour Some Sugar On Me. Came off their Hysteria album 1987. And why did we play that, you may ask? Well, Chris Dale's in the studio with us talking about ultra-processed foods. And in particular, we talk about sugar, which is a refined food and not very good for your health. So well done, Chris. And next up, we're going to talk about, something closer to home. Well, Barnsley, actually. The hydraulic press. So Joseph Bramah was born in 1748 in Stainborough in Barnsley. He was an inventor and locksmith and is best known for having invented the hydraulic press. So Joseph Bramah was educated at the local school in Silton. On leaving school, he became an apprentice to a local carpenter and later started work as a cabinet maker. Joseph Bramah soon became known for his development of the flush toilet, and he used what he had learned about the motion of fluids from installing toilets to develop the hydraulic press, which was Joseph Bramah's most important invention. Can you believe he came from Barnsley as well? So Joseph Bramah's hydraulic press is based around Pascal's law, also called Pascal's principle.
Yes, Pascal's law is about the physical properties of a fluid and says that if pressure is exerted on a fluid, this pressure will be distributed evenly throughout the fluid. It is named after Blaise Pascal, who discovered it in 1666. An example of Pascal's law is the way a fluid flows out of one syringe to another through a pipe or tube. And Pascal's barrel is the name of an experiment that was supposedly performed by Blaise Pascal to demonstrate the concept. He inserted a long vertical tube into an otherwise sealed barrel which was already filled with water. And when more water was poured into the vertical tube, the increase in pressure caused the barrel to burst. So in simple terms, a hydraulic press is basically a machine press using a hydraulic cylinder to generate a compressive force using fluid, normally a type of oil. The hydraulic press has two cylinders and pistons of different cross-sectional areas, such that if a force was placed upon or exerted on the small piston, this would be translated into a larger force on the larger piston. Joseph Bramah was granted a patent for his hydraulic press in 1795, and the hydraulic press, which is still referred to as the Brammer press, had many industrial applications and still does today.
So hydraulic presses are commonly used for lifting and pressing devices, often used for forging, clinching, moulding, blanking, punching, deep drawing and metal forming operations, if you know what any of those are. And the reason the hydraulic press is so useful in manufacturing is because it gives the ability to create more intricate shapes with less materials. Hydraulic press also takes up less space compared to a mechanical press of the same capability. So these days, hydraulic presses operate using a variety of fluids such as multigrade engine oil, automatic transmission fluid, and more conventional anti-wear hydraulic oil. At the time, Joseph Brammer was bringing his concepts of the hydraulic press to fruition. The field of what is now called hydraulic engineering was an almost unknown science. So Joseph Brammer and a fellow inventor named William George Armstrong of Cragside, which we'll come on to talk about next, were considered to be the two main pioneers in the hydraulic engineering field.
Give love, give love, give love.
Well, great track there, Under Pressure. That was 1981, can you believe, Queen with David Bowie. We played that because we were talking about the hydraulic press, and that was invented by Joseph Bramah, who was born in 1748 in Stainbury in Barnsley. And as we were saying before that piece of music, at the time, Bramah was bringing his concept of the hydraulic press to fruition. The field of what is now called hydraulic engineering was an almost unknown science. So Joseph Bramah and a fellow inventor named William George Armstrong of Cragside were considered to be two main pioneers in the hydraulic engineering field. So now we're going to talk about National Trust Cragside, Britain's original smart home, which we visited for the first time earlier this year.
Yes, Cragside Country House and Estate near the town of Rothbury in Northumberland was created by a remarkable couple, Lord William and Lady Margaret Armstrong. William Armstrong was a visionary Victorian inventor with a passion for efficiency, innovation and engineering, whilst Margaret had a love for natural science and was a keen gardener. In fact, they planted something like 7 million trees and shrubs.
Yeah, it's quite a phenomenal place.
It was a Cragside, literally. There was no vegetation at all until they came along. William George Armstrong was born in 1810 in Newcastle upon Tyne, the son of a corn merchant. He originally trained as a solicitor and moved to London. When he returned to Newcastle in 1835, he met and married Margaret Ramshaw. William went on to develop the Armstrong Whitworth Armaments from Elswick Works in Newcastle, which employed more than 25,000 people in its heyday. I think it was one of the most richest people in Europe at the time.
Possibly, yeah.
Definitely, he was really rich.
And he also renovated Bamborough Castle at a cost of today's money, in some 84 million in today's money. William also built a Newcastle swing bridge and the hydraulic mechanism that operates the Tower Bridge in London. William Armstrong had spent much of his childhood at Rothbury, and on returning to the area in 1862, he decided to buy a small parcel of land and build a modest house on the side of a moorland crag. The original house was completed in the mid-1860s and named Cragside after Cragend Hill above the house. Later, the Armstrongs commissioned the architect Norman Shaw to expand and transform the house over a period of many years. Meanwhile, by building dams, Armstrong created 5 new lakes on the Cragside estate. In 1868, a hydraulic engine was installed, and in 1870, Armstrong installed a Siemens dynamo in what was the world's first hydroelectric power station. That's 1870.
Wow, I know.
The generators provided power for the farm buildings on the estate, including a sawmill, as well as for the house itself, which had a water-powered laundry, early versions of a dishwasher and a dumbwaiter, a hydraulic lift, a hydroelectric rotisserie spit, and most brilliantly, of course, electric light.
Amazing. And a soda stream. I thought soda streams were modern, but no, there's one in Cragside. Fascinating. So Cragside was the first house in the world to be lit using hydroelectric power. Historic England notes that the use of electricity to run the house's appliances and internal systems made Cragside a pioneer of home automation, one of the first private residences to have a dishwasher, vacuum cleaner and a washing machine. The conservatory contained a self-watering system for the pot plants, which turned on water-powered revolving stands. So in 1887, William Armstrong was raised to the peerage, the first engineer or scientist to be ennobled, and became Baron Armstrong of Cragside. He died in 1900. To this day, Cragside still uses a hydroelectric system. In 2014, the National Trust, who have looked after Cragside since 1977, installed an Archimedes screw, which uses water from Tumbleton Lake. As water passes through the spiral blades, the screw turns and harnesses the energy of the falling water. The electricity produced lights the whole house, and any surplus goes to the national grid. So highly recommend, if you've never been, go and visit National Trust at Cragsides.
Yeah, and what you haven't mentioned, of course, is that the King and Queen went and stayed there.
Oh, right.
Because it was they were one of the first properties to have central heating as well as the electricity.
Amazing. Well, there you go. But it's well worth a visit, and we were well impressed. We didn't have time to go around the gardens, but there you go. But that brings us to the end of the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Join us next Saturday for the first show of the year, 2025. Thanks to all our listeners. Thanks to Chris for coming in.
Brilliant.
Happy New Year, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.